Hi, I'm Tony Cox, and this is the Marketplace Money Podcast for the weekend of December 28, 2012. A new year provides the perfect opportunity to give our personal finances a fresh start. So we ask folks, what do you resolve to change in 2013?
I guess my New Year's resolution is just to have more personal finance questions.
This year, again, is to start trying to save. That's usually every year I try to do that, but then later on falls apart.
Getting a little bit more diligent about monitoring my credit and our credit collectively would probably be the best New Year's resolution.
We have tips for keeping those money resolutions. Plus, if you have a gift card that was never redeemed, did you know you may still have a right to that cash value? In some states, it's the law.
It's their money. It's not the state's money. It's not the retailer's money. By law, this is their money, so we have a moral responsibility to return it.
All that and more coming up on Marketplace Money from APM.
Show Marketplace Money how much you like us. Stay connected to our hosts, reporters, and top stories on Facebook. Find us at facebook.com/marketplacemoney.
The new year is upon us, and while the news cycle continues to crackle with concerns about the future of our economy, some New Year traditions go on without interruption. Take college football. It's the peak of the bowl season now, with a handful of big games on New Year's Day and the BCS National Championship game a week later. Most of us, millions in fact, watch on television, but seeing the big game in person draws legions of traveling fans from across the country. Perhaps you've seen the viral video of an Alabama fan crying tears of happiness after receiving a pair of BCS championship tickets from his son for Christmas.
We going to the game, Pop! We going to the game!
For fans, it is a privilege to see their team in action, a privilege they pay a pretty penny for. Big games, big bucks. But it's worth it for my two guests. Jan Sexton of Abilene, Kansas, is headed to Arizona with six friends and family members for the Fiesta Bowl. And Ben Jordan of Dallas goes to every Alabama game he can. But the cost of this year's championship game in New Orleans will force him to sit in front of the TV instead of in the stands. Both Jan and Ben join us now to talk about the cost of being such big fans. Welcome.
Hi there. It's nice to be on.
Hello.
Jan, you get a break because your two sons, Curry and Colin, play for the Kansas State Wildcats, and players get an allotment of free tickets. We know that. And at $144 a pop or more, depending on where you sit, that's a substantial savings. But the cost of traveling for the game is still pretty high, isn't it?
It is. It is going to be extremely high this year. We were watching plane tickets, keeping a close eye on those. And as the days went on and we got to further and further into a different bowl, the plane tickets, just airfare was going extremely high. We even looked into driving to Oklahoma or up to Nebraska and taking a route there to avoid high airfare. But in the end, we decided it would be best to rent a vehicle, and we're going to drive the 16 to 17 hours there. We're leaving in the morning.
How much money are we talking about overall to get you and your group from Kansas to Arizona and back and to the game?
For seven of us, it looks like it's going to be about a $1,200 to $1,300 ticket.
Now, more than 3 million out-of-state visitors have gone to the Fiesta Bowl over the years, according to the Tostitos Fiesta Bowl figures. In order for you and your family and friends to be able to go, Jan, what sacrifices do you have to make, and how much planning is involved?
Well, we decided that it was going to be our Christmas to each other, and it was also going to be our family vacation this year, so that we're sacrificing both those things. My husband's a farmer, so we tend to take vacations in the winter months anyway, so we just knew all along we were hoping for a bowl game and then turn that into a family vacation.
Now, Ben, you're a diehard Alabama fan, and yet you'll miss maybe the biggest game they've played in years when they meet Notre Dame in the Superdome in New Orleans. How much would it have cost for you to go? And on top of that, you would have had to buy your own tickets as well, right?
Correct, yes. We looked at it. This year, it's just not doable. Tickets right now, I mean, in the upper section alone are $1,400. So, You know, you're looking at, even if it was just my father and I, which is probably who it would be. I mean, you're talking travel expenses and tickets and airfare to get him from Alabama and to get myself there and everything. You're looking at, easy at that $8,000.
That's a lot of money for a football game.
Yeah.
There are other expenses besides the game and travel, aren't there? What are some of them, Ben?
Oh, well, of course, celebrating a win afterwards can get kind of expensive. and then, of course, just, you know, the lodging and the food. And you're not going to go to the game dressed in, you know, the regular Alabama stuff you wear. Of course, I'd be wearing a championship shirt from last year, too. So,
of course you would. Well, Jan, they have other events that you have to pay for, hospitality, suites, and things that the university organizes, don't they?
They do. There's a lot of emails we've received. There's some activities going on. The pep rally will be free to fans. But then there's a pre-pep rally party and a post-pep rally party. And then there's other parties set up for alumni and the Fiesta Bowl. Just a lot of different options, but it all costs money. The least expensive thing we had an option to do was $60 a person. So with seven of us, you would take that times seven.
So we
are not going to do any of the organized extra parties. We're just going to take in the pep rally and then the actual game.
How good a deal can you get through booster and alumni groups, for example? Does that help any or no?
No, not for us. I mean, unfortunately, we haven't had anyone in our family that graduated from the University of Alabama. So, you know, the only tickets that we've ever gotten are ones that we just, you know, directly purchased or found someone that we knew somewhere that had some kind of connection.
What about with you, Jan?
I think booster packages are very convenient, and a lot of people do them because they don't have to worry about planning a thing. They just pay and they do it, and it's all set up from A to Z. So it's a really convenient option, but for us, that just wouldn't have worked out. So,
is this the only game that you travel to, the bowl game, or do you travel throughout the season, Jan?
We travel throughout the season. We made a commitment to do that when our son started playing at Kansas State, and we just said we were going to, if at all possible, and sacrifice other things to be able to go to the game. So the farthest we traveled this year was to West Virginia. They just joined the Big 12. So we did make that game, and it was an awesome experience.
Now, Ben, do you travel through to all the Alabama games?
We haven't traveled to all of them, probably in the last couple of years, just due to my family is pretty spread out. I've got my parents in Alabama, which does make it easier to get to home games there. And then my brother is in California and my sister is in Denver. So it's a little bit harder to get us all together to make those same trips that we used to. But, you know, if it's in reasonably close range, we do usually try to make all those games.
Is it worth the expense?
I would say definitely. On my end, I wouldn't miss it.
Ben?
Absolutely.
Really?
Absolutely. No question.
Does it feel like it costs more if your team loses?
Yes.
Of course.
Yes. I had to suffer that fate.
Jan Sexton of Abilene, Kansas is headed to Glendale, Arizona with a number of family and friends for the Fiesta Bowl. And unfortunately, Ben Jordan is not going to be able to see his beloved University of Alabama Crimson Tide in person this year. Like the rest of us, he'll be watching it on TV. Thank you both very much.
Thank you.
Thank you. It was fun.
Gift cards. You either love them or hate them.
Oh, God, I love gift cards. Yeah. They're nice. Well, then you can pick out something for yourself, even if it's for a specific store. It's just such a treat.
I love holiday gift cards. I get to choose what I want as opposed to somebody picking out something that's not going to fit and I'm going to have to exchange anyways. Then I got to feel bad when they ask, why aren't you wearing it? Like somebody bought me Beats headphones once. When am I going to use that? Where am I going to put that in my pocket? I wear my little sister's jeans. It's not really going to fit in there.
Oh, I hate holiday gift cards.
Oh, yeah, I know that.
Terrible. They're impersonal. They're not about the spirit of giving. You have to spend time and think about what you have to give someone.
I would rather just get like a nice handwritten note and get no present.
That's true, too. That's good.
I like the thoughtfulness.
Well, whether you think gift cards are great or not, many of us will head into the new year with the gift cards we got for Christmas. And some of us will put them down someplace, planning to use them when we have time. But a lot of gift cards never get redeemed, and the money spent buying them just goes to waste. There ought to be a law, and there is. Maria Altman of St. Louis Public Radio reports on one Midwestern state that returns unused gift card cash to its rightful owner, you.
In Missouri, it's pretty easy to see if the state is holding on to gift card money you may have forgotten. My friend Jill Miller types her name into the state's website, showmemoney.com. This is the Show Me State.
Sure enough, there was my name with my old address.
Jill has at least $30 waiting to be claimed. She's given several gift cards to friends over the years, and as she stares at the amount she's owed, she admits she's been given a few gift certificates that she can't quite locate.
I guess it wouldn't be too surprising that there might be something that didn't catch up with me, although I don't know what it would be.
So far this year, Missouri has returned more than $100,000 from expired gift cards and certificates, and State Treasurer Clint Zweifel says his office has another $6 million to give back.
It's their money. It's not the state's money. It's not the retailer's money. By law, this is their money, so we have a moral responsibility to return it.
Missouri is among at least 25 states that require retailers to turn over money from unused gift cards and certificates. Most retailers readily comply, since unused gift cards count as a liability on their books. But states get a benefit, too. While they look for the owner, they can use the money. It's like a 0% interest loan.
I think more and more states are looking for more revenue, so they will grab whatever they can. And unclaimed gift cards is just one of those ways.
Odysseus Papadimitriou is the CEO of CardHub, a clearinghouse for credit and gift cards. He says estimates of gift card sales this year will total $110 billion. Of that, about 2% will go unredeemed.
There is billions of dollars literally that we're talking here. And, you know, if a state can get its hands on an interest-free loan, I don't think any state governor, especially with this economy, will not go for it.
But back in Missouri, Treasurer Zweifel says a big part of his job is educating people so that they never have to make a claim for their own money.
Use that card and use it sooner if possible. But also, if you plan on holding on to that card for a while before using it, simply make a copy of it and put it in a safe deposit box or a safe place in your home so that you have a backup copy and ultimately so that you have proof that that was your card.
As for my friend Jill, she won't be able to find out where exactly her $30 came from unless she asks the state once she gets her refund check.
Maybe it'll always be a mystery, but that's okay. Money is money.
In St. Louis, I'm Maria Altman for Marketplace.
With all the holiday shopping now behind us, it's time to take back the things we thought we wanted or the gifts where it was only the thought that counted. But sometimes retailers can make returning items a chore. So if you've run into any trouble or gotten the runaround from a business, LA Times consumer columnist David Lazarus might like a word with you. We've invited him to the show next week to answer listeners' questions. So share your post-season store experience with us at marketplace.org. It is nearly time for a new year, and for some of us, that means a fresh start for our personal finance habits. Spending less and saving more is consistently ranked as one of the top New Year's resolutions, like losing weight or getting organized. It takes discipline, of course. But when it comes to managing money right, self-control isn't the only asset. Information is also key. And so we've invited one of the most informed personal finance experts we know to the show today to talk about making realistic money goals and help a few callers out as well. Liz Weston, that's you. How are you?
Great. Good to see you.
Nice to have you. Where do a lot of people go wrong with making New Year's resolutions related to money?
Well, it's like New Year's resolutions related to anything else. They try to be too ambitious and they are also a little vague. You know, what you need are very concrete goals that you actually have a realistic hope of achieving. You know, if you have $50,000 in debt, you're not going to get it paid off in a year unless you're making a heck of a lot more money than we are. So you need to have a goal that you can actually achieve. Like, you know, I want to get X amount of my debt paid off. I want to take a look at my portfolio and get that in shape. Something that's very specific and concrete that you actually can accomplish.
And something you have to do in small pieces, small increments.
Exactly. You know, it's a lifestyle change you have to ease into and keep up over time.
Well, let's see if we can help some of the people who are on the line with us today. You ready to take a couple of calls?
Sounds great, Tony.
Let's go to the first one. This is Amy from Coon Rapids, Minnesota. Hi, Amy. Coon Rapids, Minnesota, really? Amy, yeah. Really?
It might be easier to just say Minneapolis, but yes, it is a suburb.
That is wild. Anyway, we're glad that you called us. What is your question for Liz?
Well, about a month and a half ago, my partner and I received a notice from a major insurance carrier that their database had been hacked, and unfortunately, they didn't really specify what kind of information that was received or hacked, or even if either one of us were at risk, but they did offer a one-year consumer protection. And when we contacted them to try to see what information we could get, they were really vague, refused to take us out of their database. And now I'm just at odds as to how should we handle this down the road? Should we take their 1 year of consumer protection? Can we pull our own credits, or should we be using that free credit report offering by the three different credit reporting agencies on our own? Because I've heard that you could basically your credit report gets dinged every time that you run that report.
Oh, Amy, the good news is that's not actually true. If you're looking at your own credit, pulling your own credit reports, signing up for credit monitoring, it typically doesn't even show up on your credit report, and it's certainly not what's known as a hard inquiry. So you're not dinging your score. And interestingly, that's a myth that just keeps persisting. I wrote a book about credit scoring, and I had a chapter on myths. I've barely had to touch that over 10 years because the same myths come up, and this is one of the most common that somehow checking your own credit is going to hurt your score. It won't.
Okay.
Here's the issue with the consumer protection they're offering. I'm assuming it's credit monitoring of some kind?
Yeah.
Okay. Sometimes the companies are asking you to sign away some rights when you sign up for that. So read the fine print carefully before you go for that. Also, ideally, it would be credit monitoring of all three credit bureaus.
Okay.
Often when I see these offers, it's just one credit bureau. That's not, that's kind of helpful for free, but not all that helpful because you need to know what's going on with the other two bureaus as well.
Yeah.
I'm really frustrated that these companies are not being more forthcoming because it would really help make decisions if you knew, okay, do they just have my address or do they have my Social Security number?
Right.
If anybody had your Social Security number, I'd say go get a credit freeze. This is when you lock down your credit reports at all three bureaus. Sometimes you have to pay fees for that. Sometimes it's free. But essentially, a lender couldn't access your credit information without your permission. So that means, an identity thief couldn't go and open an account typically in your name. It'd be much harder to do it. So, but since you don't know, it's really hard to judge what you might need to do. I think at a minimum, I'd go to the three credit bureaus and put what's called a fraud alert on my credit report. That's a signal to lenders that they have to do a little something extra to, verify that it's you. And also, I highly recommend the ID Theft Center that's in San Diego. I think it's idtheftcenter.org on the internet. They have a ton of information about breaches and what you should do. Also, the Privacy Rights Clearinghouse is another place that has a ton of information about breaches and things that you should look for. So I would definitely educate yourself. Don't take this casually because they've notified you that there's some kind of problem. Unfortunately, they're not being very forthcoming about what it could be.
Hey, Amy, I have a question for you before we let you go.
Yeah.
Do you make New Year's resolutions or do you have one this year?
Well, since I have lost a significant amount of weight in the last year, I think I can put that off the list.
But hey, congratulations. That's awesome.
Thanks. But I think in light of this dilemma, I think probably getting a little bit more diligent about monitoring my credit and our credit collectively would probably be the best New Year's resolution.
Sounds like a good idea to me. Thank you very much for the call, Amy, and happy holiday to you.
Happy holidays.
Looking for a good read? Visit the Big Book blog at marketplace.org. Listen to author interviews and read excerpts from the Marketplace bookshelf. Online at marketplace.org/thebigbook.
This is Marketplace Money from APM. Liz Weston is with us today answering your money questions, and we're talking to callers about their New Year's resolutions. On the line now, Jamshed from Beechwood, Ohio. Jamshed, how are you?
I'm fine. How are you?
What's your New Year's resolution?
Well, that's one of the resolutions that I guess I have every year. This year, again, is to start trying to save. That's usually every year I try to do that, but then later on falls apart. But hopefully I try to do a little bit more better job in saving money.
All right, this year, 2013, this is going to be the year that you're going to do it and stick with it, right?
Yes, 13 is always the lucky one.
There you go. So what's your question for Liz Jamshi?
Yeah, you know, like a lot of people, obviously me and my wife both have a lot of credit cards. And for some of those, I'm the primary person and she's the secondary one. And for the others, she's the primary and I'm the secondary one. So as far as I understand it, obviously if there is no balance in there, it would be fine that, you know, we both have that, those credits under our name. But my question is that what about when we have significant balances on these credit cards? Would it be better for our credit scores if, like, we just keep the primary person on the account and take the secondary one off? That way, obviously, the amount of credit available to us will go down, but at the same time, the amount that we owe also will go down. Would that make any change in our credit score, or it would stay the same?
Well, the devil's in the details, Jamshid. So let me ask you, how many credit cards are we talking about? What are the balances as opposed to the credit limits?
We're talking about probably
Seven cards, okay.
And the available credit on all of those is about $90,000, and it's owed about $80,000 on all of those.
Wow.
Whoa.
Yeah. Okay. This $80,000 debt, how much is that in relation to your income?
Probably it's about 1/7 of my income.
Oh.
Yeah.
So you're doing quite well.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. Well, That relieves
better,
some
huh?
of my anxiety, because normally with that much debt, I would say you got to talk to a bankruptcy attorney.
Yeah.
You know?
Okay. No, I'm not that. But it's been like that for a long time. That amount has not gone down over time.
Now, why is that?
That's my New Year resolution.
Okay. Sounds like you're making over $500,000 a year. Is that right?
Yeah.
Okay. Where is the money going?
Kids' schools, mortgages. Private schools.
Mm-hmm. Well, private schools are expensive. How many kids do you have?
3.
Now, that's a chunk of change, but you still should not be carrying that much debt. I mean, a lot of people think that credit card debt is normal, and it's really not. Right now, or at least as of 2010, fewer than 40% of American families had any credit card debt, and the median amount was under $3,000. So you guys are definitely outliers, and it is putting you at risk of bankruptcy, even though you have a good income. Okay, here's the deal. Are you an authorized user or a joint user on your wife's cards?
Joint user.
Okay, and is she the same on yours?
Yes.
Okay. Getting off as a joint user is kind of tough. That you typically would have to open a new account, transfer the balance. If your credit scores aren't sterling, that could trigger a review of your account. And I'm not sure it would accomplish what you're hoping to accomplish, because the debt is still going to be a significant part of, you know, your credit reports as well as hers, even if you manage to separate them somehow. So unless I'm missing something significant, I think what you guys really need to do is, you know, focus on paying down that debt, because paying it down will ultimately help your scores a lot more than trying to move it around or play games with whose name is on what. Does that make sense?
It does. So I guess we just leave it alone the way it is and stick to our New Year's resolution.
You are saving for retirement, right?
Yes.
Okay. So now that retirement's taken care of, just get at that debt and make sure you get rid of it. Got to take care of this.
In 2013. Jamshid, thank you very much. Good luck. And we're going to save in 2013, right?
Thank you. Yes.
Absolutely. Thank you for calling.
Thanks. All right. Bye.
Let's take another caller.
Okay.
All right. Doreen from Lexington, Kentucky. Hi, Doreen.
Hi there. I'm so excited to be with you all today.
Well, we are excited to have you as well. So what is your question for Liz?
Well, I am the extremely proud parent of a college student who has just finished her first semester of her freshman year.
Good for you.
And so I've been listening to all of the discussions about the looming fiscal cliff and how deductions may change, and I'm getting ready to pay the fees for her spring semester. And so I was listening to these various discussions, and I thought, well, golly, if I pay for the 2013 spring semester in 2012, would that not count to the payments that I make for college in 2012 that would potentially be able to take advantage of whatever tax deductions there are for college payments in 2012 that may change in 2013?
Ah, that's an excellent question.
It is interesting, yeah.
So as far as my daughter's university is concerned, they don't care whether the check is dated 12/31 or 1/1. They are still counting it towards 2013 as far as the tax year.
Oh, that's interesting.
Well, that's what I thought too, because I don't make a charitable contribution, you know, that
right.
I say, oh, do I want it this year or that year, you know? I mean,
yeah, Tony, this is something that's pretty routine of people paying
their
things ahead, like their property taxes
right.
or their mortgage or whatever. And it's kind of unfortunate the college doesn't let you do that. In this case, I'm not sure it will make a difference one way or the other. Now, one of the things we've been talking about with the fiscal cliff is how confusing it's made everything, because if all the rates do go up and all these deductions do disappear, you're kind of supposed to do the opposite of what you normally do. You normally, you know, want to speed up deductions, put off income. If we go over the fiscal cliff, you'll have want to do the opposite. Okay, here's the big problem. The college tuition deduction expired at the end of 2011, and Congress has not renewed that. So it's one of those things that just they have not gotten around to. They're way behind on their housekeeping. What does still exist is the American Opportunity Tax Credit. Okay, that's expiring at the end of this year. There's been some people saying that people should take advantage of the American Opportunity Tax Credit by prepaying their 2013 expenses if the college will play along, which yours is not doing. By the way, I'm getting all this information from a wonderful guy named Mark Luscombe. He's at CCH. It's a tax research firm. He knows this stuff. And what he told me is the credit that we're talking about is limited to $2,500. It's 100% of the first $2,000 of tuition and fees you pay and 25% of the next $2,000 of tuition and fees you pay. If you paid your fall semester already, 2012, which you have, mm-hmm. you may have already used up this credit. So that's why I was saying it's probably not an issue that the college won't play ball by moving expenses into 2012, because mm-hmm. you've probably already used the credit that's available.
But it's the American Opportunity Tax Credit that would be applicable in this case.
Right, because the college tuition deduction, which could also be helpful to you, has already expired. Now, it may get renewed. Again, this is all up in the air, so we don't know. But at this point, the tax break that's available to you is this tax credit. It's limited to $2,500 of tuition and fees, so you probably already used it up. Does that help?
That helps tremendously. I'm the tax preparer for our family. We have extremely simple taxes, which is great.
Well, you don't anymore now that you're
going
to college.
Absolutely.
Well, and see, that's it. I've never had to do the tax return and look at these credits mm-hmm. and so on and so forth. So that's why it's good to have you all in my treasure trove of knowledge to go to. So I guess my New Year's resolution is just to have more personal finance questions that I can ask you all.
That would be great. Doreen, thank you very much for calling, and Happy New Year to you.
Great. Thank you, Tony, and thank you, Liz.
Liz, like she said, thank you very much for helping us out. As you always do, you are great at doing this. Liz Weston is a personal finance columnist. You can find her money tips and more at AskLizWeston.com. Liz, Happy New Year.
Happy New Year, Tony.
There are countless resources for those of us who want to be better money managers, you know, like this show. But comedian Tim Bedore says The Pawn Shop is also a good place to go to learn some important lessons about personal finance.
My 14-year-old daughter announced the other day that she plans to be smart about money like her mom and dad. I didn't tell her that my wife and I aren't so much smart about money as we are cheap. But I did say, if you want to be smart about money, go to a pawn shop, see what they've got the most of, and never buy it. Almost by definition, everything you see in a pawn shop represents a mistake of some kind. I thought of this because while waiting to get my tires rotated last week, I wandered into a pawn shop, and from what I saw, if you buy a bass guitar, you're going to have financial trouble. This pawn shop had 32 guitars, 22 were basses. I'm no psychologist, but my guess is because women go for rock stars, at least 22 guys figured, I'm not musical, I can't play guitar, but maybe I can play bass. There's two fewer strings, how hard can it be? There was also every iteration of every device Apple's ever made. Macs, iPods, iPhones, iPads, literally 100 Apple products. It would appear Apple users are only happy when they have the latest version of everything from the Apple Store. But that also means they're going to have lots of old versions to sell too. And then there were all those DVDs, aisles and aisles. When you bought that Adam Sandler movie, did you really think you were going to watch it over and over again? How many times do you need to see Spanglish? So I came home for my free tire rotation, which took about 90 minutes because free means waiting, another economics lesson, and told my daughter about what I saw at the pawn shop. I told her if she wants to be smart about money, steer clear of DVDs, bass guitars, and certainly don't covet everything Apple puts out. I told her that while holding up my 7-year-old iPod Classic that still works just fine. And she shot back, Dad, how much do they want for one of those bass guitars? I have lunch with a really cool guy at school who thinks he should be in a rock band. I don't know if my 14-year-old daughter is going to be smart about money, but she is already smart enough to know how to send her dad into a panic.
Tim Bedore is a father and stand-up comedian based in Minneapolis. Since many schools are on break for the New Year holiday, we decided to fill that void with a little Shakespeare. Wait. Since when does Shakespeare have anything to do with money, you ask? Well, since the college course Shakespeare and Financial Markets was introduced at Duke University to explore that very connection. Classic Shakespeare plays like Hamlet and Julius Caesar are used to teach students about what drives financial behavior. The class is taught by visiting Professor John Fourlines III. He is a former investment banker, and he joins us now. John, welcome.
Glad to be here, Tony.
All right, right away, can you make the link for us between Shakespeare's writings and economics?
I think it's clear when you delve into Shakespeare, and of course, I've spent a lifetime of looking at Shakespeare and also, you know, being in the financial markets, that human behavior is behind so much of what we do in our lives and also, most important, in our decision-making. And Shakespeare held up a mirror to humans and showed us how we behave, probably one of the first artists to really capture that. And when you look at some of the mistakes, both policy-wise and also by investors in the last 20 or so years, you see a lot of those behaviors. And so drawing out those connections is part of what made the course, I think, for me and also for the students, a lot of fun this year.
All right, let's talk about some specific examples. The big economic story of the time, as you know, is the fiscal cliff. So what Shakespeare text would you use to explain the behavior that we are seeing now from people who are worried about this financial deadline?
I think I would pull out The Winter's Tale. King Leontes has a lifetime of experience of coming up through the royal court and has a lovely wife and family. And in a matter of minutes, because he sees a childhood friend cavorting with his wife innocently, he throws away all his history, imperils his kingdom, and then indirectly causes the death of his son. And so the connection to Shakespeare, The Winter's Tale, deals in first instance with a bias many investors have called the availability bias. And that is, despite all our teachings and learning and going to see your personal financial advisor or whatever, individual investors tend to pull down the latest available information and give it more credence than all the stuff that's come along before. And so similarly, with the fiscal cliff, it's not a new topic. It's been around a long time. But suddenly, it's in the media. It's available. And so people are grasping it and pulling it down and saying, it must impact my investments. It must impact my investments. And in truth, it probably won't that much. So there's, you know, the availability bias is a big deal. Pulling down that information that came anew and obscuring all the stuff that you learned before is a big lesson for American investors and, in fact, investors everywhere.
It's interesting that you would pick A Winter's Tale because that's one of the Shakespeare plays that's listed as a comedy. And it would seem that for what we are going through and what you may be teaching your students at Duke, that more of Shakespeare's tragedies would be appropriate.
Yeah, well, The Winter's Tale is actually it hasn't played much in the United States. It's actually done a lot more over in the UK and also in Europe. It's a play that it's sort of in two halves. It has a play of true tragic dimensions as the first part, as I just described. But in the end, there is a redemptive quality to it. But in terms of tragedy, when you think about, if you want to stick with the availability bias, you know, Hamlet's a great example, seeing his father's ghost, and all of a sudden his whole decision-making mode turns on to a theme of madness almost instantaneously, despite the fact he knows a lot of other information that's probably much more relevant to his behavior. And the decisions that Hamlet makes result in some very terrible things, not the least of which is practically the death of half the court at the end of the play. But that's an example of how an availability bias can actually turn into what we call an availability cascade. And that's where the tragedy is when, say, a 2008 occurs and everyone does the same thing and all people are participating in similar bad behaviors, all acting on very recent information and then, you know, jumping over the cliff.
You're an English scholar, but also a businessman with experience in investment banking and corporate securities. Is there a Shakespeare quote that you can leave us with that has helped you in your own management of money?
There sure is. It's Brutus's quote from Julius Caesar. The quote goes, "There is a tide in the affairs of men, which, taken at the flood, leads on to fortune. Omitted, all the voyage of their life is bound in shallows and miseries. On such a full sea are we now afloat, and we must take the current when it serves, or lose our ventures."
So in other words, go with the flow.
Go with the flow and find, in the case of personal investments, spend your time finding a very good advisor and then watch other TV shows besides ones that focus particularly on your investments.
John Fourlines III is a visiting professor at Duke University, where he teaches the course Shakespeare and Financial Markets. Again, John, thank you.
Tony, thanks for having me on.
The new year is the time that homeowner association fees often come due. Tens of millions of Americans live under this pay-to-stay agreement, which is governed by a group of peer owners. And yet, getting the biggest bang for your neighborhood buck can be complicated. Megan Verley of Colorado Public Radio has the story.
For Stan Horencevich, the trouble all started a couple of winters ago when a neighbor ran over to point out all the snow plows driving up and down their streets.
So one might ask, what's the big deal there?
Well, the problem was it was 4 days after the snowstorm. The streets were empty. The streets were empty. There wasn't even runoff on the streets.
Horencevich pays around $200 a month in HOA fees for the development where he lives south of Denver, and he wasn't happy to see them going for this.
I want snow service, but I don't want my empty streets plowed.
So Horencevich started asking for records. The board turned him down, and that led to a multi-year lawsuit. That wasn't what Horencevich had in mind when he got interested in HOA finances.
This was supposed to be something very easy, something that I could get my hands on. It's small. We all supposedly know and work with each other, supposed to be cooperative.
Horencevich is now the unofficial leader of a movement to make HOAs more accountable in Colorado. But Colorado realtor Jim Smith says HOAs are something homebuyers rarely think about.
Very seldom, but less than 1 out of 10, probably 1 out of 20, has an opinion formed about HOAs and has a desire either to be in an HOA or not to be in an HOA.
But more and more Americans are living in these so-called association-governed communities, More than 60 million people, according to an industry lobbying group. And those associations collect more than $40 billion a year in fees. All that money can lead to friction, and there's been an increasing push in recent years to give residents more power in disputes with management companies. But if fighting an HOA is tough, running one can be even harder.
Things are not as simple as I thought they were.
Janet Lucas was unhappy about how her dues were being spent, or not spent. The development's roads were cracking, the landscaping was getting jungly. So she ran for her HOA board and quickly found out life isn't easy on the other side of the purse strings.
It is like running a small city. Something that I'm very, very concerned about is the budget and dealing with other people's money, which actually I'm more cautious about than with my own.
Lucas's condo association collects more than $750,000 a year in fees, which sounds like a lot of money. But with it, her board has to pay for road maintenance, roofing, condo repairs, landscaping, and two pools. And that's just the stuff residents notice. Her big headache right now is less tangible. Homeowners associations have to have insurance, and insurance is going up.
The increase we're facing is approximately 1.5 times what our premium was for last year. The premium last year increased 55% over the previous year.
Lucas describes some of her time on the condo board as a nightmare, but she's also obviously proud of the community she's working for. And remember Stan Horencevich, the guy whose frustration with unnecessary snowplows led to a lawsuit? After all of that, he's still a big fan of his HOA and the HOA idea in general.
It's a very stable neighborhood. It provides stability, if, in more cases than not, appreciation of home values, understanding before you get in there the contract that you'll pay for these things and you'll give up some rights. The attractiveness of the community is what I like.
As Horencevich sees it, residents just need to be prepared for one big unwritten fee that comes with living in an HOA, the cost of their time to make sure they're getting their money's worth. In Denver, Colorado, I'm Megan Verlee for Marketplace.
You might be planning your New Year's Eve party at this very moment, and if you are, listen up. Commentator Scott Hewler has some important money tips to make sure there's no bah humbug at your holiday bash.
This year, I finally understood the science behind party planning. Like a research assistant with lab animals, party hosts control their guests' behavior through food. I figured this out when I recently attended a party that ran out of food. The party started at 7, and when I arrived at 8:20, nothing. Not chili scrapings or salsa residue, not forgotten pieces of celery near the almost empty cup of ranch, or the broken halves of somebody's last-minute store-bought cookies. This is an annual party, and the people who attend agree. This happens every year. So the only conclusion I can reach? The party runs out of food on purpose. The host has made a decision to end the party early using behavioral economics. When the food runs out, people leave. I arrived at 8:20 and, foodless, I was gone by 10 to 9. I guarantee you, the host of that party had a clean kitchen and was watching a video by 11, which was probably the goal. Think about it. If you put out enough food to last all night, people stand around the nacho wreckage at 11:45, carrying on conversations about college girlfriends. That's the party for me, by the way. I worked a variation of this principle with bird seed at home. No seed, no birds. Totally full bird feeder, gangs of goldfinches descend on the yard like hell's angels. If the seed is lousy, birds will come occasionally until the seed gets moldy. I tinkered with mixes, trying to find the right way to keep enough birds around to entertain me without eating me out of house and home. Same with parties. You put out enough food, and food of a certain quality, to bring the number of guests you want and have them stay as long as you want. And guests, like my backyard birds, will tell you how well you've calculated. Wake up the next day with a guest still on the couch? You probably did swell. Empty house at 10? You may have miscalibrated. Unless that's what you wanted. As for that annual party I mentioned earlier, I believe I'm going to vote with my wings, feet. Next year, when it rolls around, I think I may stay home and have some bird seed.
Scott Hewler is a writer living in Raleigh, North Carolina. His latest book is On the Grid. The end of the year means deadlines for a whole host of things. One big one, getting your financial house in order. All right, so it's not as fun as shopping. But making a few smart money moves before December 31st is key for securing a good financial future in the new year and beyond. That's our cue for Today Show financial editor Jean Chatsky, who joins us now. You can catch her new TV show, Money Matters, on RLTV. Jean, nice talking to you.
It's nice to talk to you, too.
Let's talk about the end of the year, Jean, because this is the time that you're supposed to pay attention to your money and look ahead into the coming year. One of the first areas I want to ask you about is this, unemployment. It's still high, and lots of people are making ends by picking up freelance work. Are there any year-end tips for all of these freelancers out there?
Well, if you have been picking up freelance work, you definitely want to pay attention to setting aside enough to pay your tax bills as that month, as those bills become due. Often when you're working freelance, the money comes in a lump sum. Taxes aren't taken out. If you spend it all, you're going to find yourself in a hole after the calendar year turns. So just be careful there. It's also more difficult if you've been freelancing to stay on any sort of a budget. And if you can figure out, even by averaging 3 or 4 months worth of income, what your monthly take is approximately, it'll be a lot easier to set a budget that you can stick to.
Now, talk about the financial tune-up. Is this the time of year that we are supposed to do that?
It's a great time of year to do that. This is the time of year that we pay attention to end-of-the-year tax moves. We get rid of the losers in our portfolio in order to write them off against anything that we've actually made money on. And we make sure that we've got all of our deductions in order.
Given all of the complexities of what is happening right now, do we need to hire an expert, a financial advisor, or can we handle this ourselves? And what do you do if you have to handle it yourself?
So, yes, you can handle it yourself, but you shouldn't kid yourself that it doesn't take any time. Somebody has to do the work, and that person can be a financial advisor, but it can also be you. And I think the easiest thing to do, and it's something that we talk about on my show, Money Matters, is to focus on a few simple, basic money rules.
What are the money rules that we should adopt for 2013?
One of my money rules is count dollars like calories, which essentially means track your spending. One of my absolute favorites is that if you can't see it and you can't touch it, then you won't spend it. And that argues for having money swiped out of your checking account and put away someplace safe where you're not going to touch it. And finally, automate. Anything that you can do to take financial decisions off your plate and just make them happen automatically is going to be good for your financial future.
One last thing.
Yes.
Looking into 2013, traditionally we are told to plan months in advance. Sometimes if you're able to have 6 months of reserve, things like that. Has it changed where today we can no longer plan that far ahead, or how far should we try to plan ahead with regard to what we're going to be spending?
Well, those guidelines are for emergency cushions in general. We want people to have a 3 to 6 month emergency cushion in case they lose a job, in case for some reason they're unable to work, and they need to have some stash of cash that they could actually live on. I don't think that's changed at all. If you look at the unemployment rates, that argues for keeping even a more substantial emergency cushion. Now, granted, the fact that unemployment has been so high for so long means that it's been difficult for many people to amass an emergency cushion of that size. But as your financial fortunes improve, that is definitely something that you want to make sure you do.
Very good advice. Today's show financial editor Jean Chatsky. Her most recent book is Money Rules, The Simple Path to Lifelong Security. Jean, thank you very much.
Oh, my pleasure.
You can find more of Jean Chatsky's Money Rules for 2013 at our website, marketplace.org. That is Marketplace Money for this week. Let us know what you think at marketplace.org or on our Facebook page. And keep up with the show on Twitter at Radio Piggy Bank. Next time, why millions of Americans don't get paid for the hours they actually work.
It's common practice for firms to just say we don't pay overtime as if it's a personal choice. It's not a personal choice. There are clear laws on this.
Marketplace Money is produced this week by John Haas with Lindsay Foster Thomas and Candace Manriquez. Our theme was composed by Mark Governor. The executive producer of the program is Deborah Clark. The Marketplace General Manager is J.J. Yule. I'm Tony Cox. Happy New Year, everybody.
There's a lot packed into an hour of Marketplace Money. Check it out again on our website at marketplace.org or take the show with you. Download the show by clicking on the subscribe to podcast link and never miss an episode again.
This is APM.